I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, farting here at the counter in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Cove.
And with us today is Emmy Potter, Emmy writer and actor, written for Consequence of Sound, Brightwell Dark Room. It is so good to have you here to talk about Tumbleweeds.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
And I'll tell you, it's nice to see you. And I've seen real life tumbleweeds recently. I've driven far enough away from this city where I see actual tumbleweeds. Yeah. Because my son has a sonic addiction. So every 3 months or so, I drive him out to a city pretty far away, like Alhambra or something. That's not what it is, but a city very far away to go get Sonic. And we drive past tumbleweeds. So that's my previous association with this film.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Kenny, but when you said Sonic, my brain goes to the hedgehog.
I went there too.
So I'm just like,
no, it's the hamburger joint.
Yeah, no,
and
I get it now.
I support that as well.
I support both of these, but yeah. I just, at first my brain was like, do they go to the desert and run around to look like Sonic?
While they are drinking a Route 44 cherry limeade.
Yeah.
But you know,
tumbleweeds. I get it. You know, it's a little on the nose in terms of as far as allegorical titles go.
Sure,
But Emmy, before we get more into it, how are you? Thank you for joining us. How has your pandemic been?
Well, you know, same as anyone in my apartment for days on end. I'm in New York, so I have lots of interaction with the noises that my neighbors make that I'm never have any idea what they are and what they're doing. Dragging furniture across the floor. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. Doing the Jane Fonda workout. That's actually me. Really? I've been doing it's there's so many like bootlegs on YouTube. It's it's fantastic. I too love Sonic. I don't live close enough to one. I have never lived more than a block away from a Sonic until I moved to New York City like 10
from
years
where?
Ago. From the middle of Missouri.
Okay. They call that Sonic country.
Yeah. And there was like a Sonic, there was like a Sonic on the corner near my house. And then I went to school in Oklahoma City, and Oklahoma is where Sonic started. America's Drive-In. This is like an ad for Sonic.
We should honestly try to get some money for this.
Sonic is fantastic.
It's great.
You
can get a 99-cent corn dog.
Yeah. You have to be down to just be a glutton. Just go all out. Try the whole menu.
I've never been to Sonic, but you guys have convinced me to go. So,
you know.
It takes some work.
Well, you have In-N-Out. You have other burger choices.
Fat Burger.
In California. You know.
Yeah, I defended Fat Burger until I got it last week. It's not In-N-Out.
So here's a question for you, Emmy. Did you see this film in 99 or around 99? Or what made you see this film?
So I know I definitely did not see this movie in a theater in 1999. And I don't even know if I saw it in 99. It's very hazy. But I remember my mother was the one that was interested in seeing it. She'd probably been reading like our weekly copy of Entertainment Weekly or something. And both of my parents have theater degrees. I also at this point have a musical theater degree. My family is very theatrical. My brother works in the film TV industry. But like, I just remember my mom probably read about it and was like, this sounds like something I'd be interested in. And so I remember getting it from one of our video rental stores, RIP. Those are all gone. But I remember we rented it at some point, and I don't know if it was just me and my mom who watched it, but I do remember like we rented it probably on VHS tape from one of the rental stores, Blockbuster, Movie Gallery, something.
Sure. This is one of those films, and I don't want to speak for Kenny, but I feel like he'll probably agree with me, which is I didn't really know this movie existed. Short of Janet Mateer's Academy Award nomination, which I don't mean to laugh. She's very good in this movie, but I think I could name 10 other performances off the top of my head from 99 that probably would have been nominated before her. But I just remember she gets the Academy Award nomination, and the film did pretty well. I mean, it was a success. But
after the award, won the musical comedy award at the Golden Globes. Mm-hmm. So this, in this year of all years, she had some serious momentum behind her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those. So this movie kind of certainly exists side by side with Anywhere But Here, which also comes out in 1999.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Emmy, we did
that
movie.
I have. I often get it confused with Where the Heart Is because both star Natalie Portman in rural areas, and she has an inexplicable Southern accent. But
and released by 20th Century Fox.
Yeah, and they came out like within a year of each other. Yep. So I'm always like, wait, which one do I mean? Is it the one where she has the baby in the Walmart, or is it the one where Susan Sarandon is her mother?
The one with Susan Sarandon.
They both have very evocative titles that tell you exactly what they're about, so it's weird that you get these confused.
Yeah, they're not vague titles at all.
Yeah, not at all.
Anywhere But Here comes out the same year. Kenny and I did an episode on Anywhere But Here with Rochelle Lefebvre, what feels like maybe 20 years ago now. Is that when we did it, Kenny?
It was 20, but it's an episode we mention a lot because Rochelle was able to take us both not liking the film to loving the film.
Yeah.
And it's And it was with Anywhere But Here in my head that I watched this movie, which I think, one, is vastly inferior. And two, maybe I'm wrong because I was dead wrong on Anywhere But Here. But having seen Anywhere But Here and having had the conversation with Rochelle about it and kind of knowing what to be on the lookout for, I felt like I got nothing from this movie that I got from Anywhere But Here. So I could be wrong. Maybe, I mean, I don't know if you like it or love it or you're indifferent towards it, but I am prepared to be convinced differently.
Well, I do think that I wish that there was a world where we could take the strengths of both films and make one film about a mother and a daughter on a road trip together across the country. So there's a part of me that's like, I think both of these films do some stuff really well and some stuff not as well. But what's interesting about this movie as opposed to Anywhere But Here is that this film gets the critics. This film gets, you know, the Academy Award nomination. This film gets the Golden Globes. Whereas Anywhere But Here comes out in September and perhaps it was a release date thing and people, you know, whatever the case might be. But this film comes out right in the Academy Award corridor, November 24th. Like it's right there, you know, for the taking and all of that. I guess my question to you is, you saw this when you were a teenager, Emmy?
I would have been probably like, if this came out in 99, not to make anyone feel old, I would have been 11. Six? So
we've had people that have been like six.
I have a young face. I have a young face. I'm a 32-year-old adult woman at this point. But yeah, I would have been 11 or 12 probably.
Okay, so this film comes out a little bit before your teenage years, but but you're actually kind of around the age of Ava.
Yeah.
Did this film sort of, I mean, I guess, you know, you said you watched this with your mom. I mean, I'm assuming that there's some sort of a, you know, something to be taken away from it if you're sitting next to your mom with a film about a little girl and her mom. Like, did you have a positive experience? Did you like it when you were a kid?
I think I remember probably liking it. Like, it had been so long since I had seen it that I really didn't remember a lot about it other than the very basic plot line.
Sure.
But I've always been such like a precocious kid and I was always like 3 going on 30, like I was already watching a ton of different stuff, so like it's not that I would have seen like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, but it's like I was a sophisticated enough kid that probably I can't imagine that I didn't enjoy it. And I think probably like even though that wouldn't have been my experience obviously with my mother, I think the movie gets a lot of stuff right about really solid mother-daughter relationships. And there's a lot of like nice specificities to the writing and the repartee between these two actors that that feels so genuine to like a mother-daughter experience. Like I've always had a really good relationship with my parents and always a pretty good relationship with my mom. And I don't remember ever getting super rebellious as like a teenager against my mother, but like, you know, you have your moments of like butting heads. And I think there's plenty in the movie that like gets at those moments of prickliness, maybe not so much with the same specificity that I would have seen in something like Lady Bird, which really felt more accurate to my experiences sometimes with my mom, or maybe even Anywhere But Here, but it's been a while since I've seen that.
Well, so. I think it's, so I want to talk about the Gavin O'Connor of it all a little bit, because Gavin O'Connor.
Can you deal with that for a sec? I want to go on what Emmy was just saying.
Please. Yeah.
Cause I think that you're kind of I think you did hit on where my issues with this film lie. I love Lady Bird, and I thought Anywhere But Here ultimately kind of proved to be a movie that really, really spoke to me upon reflection. And they're set up in a way that they're set up to succeed because mm-hmm. because you have a very strong conflict at the center of those movies, coupled with the inescapability of the mother-daughter or parent-child relationship. You're stuck with this person that you can't stand. Mm-hmm. And I really thought that was very strong about Anywhere But Here, this idea of it doesn't matter how much you personally like this person, or even if this person is emotionally abusive towards you. If this person is taking you, if your mother is taking you across the country, you have no choice but to go. Mm-hmm. And that kind of spoke to me, both in terms of, you know, reflections on my real life, but also the power of the moment within the movie. The relationship between Jenna McTeer and her daughter, Ava, the actress's name is Kimberly Brown.
Kimberly Brown.
Yeah.
Is very positive.
Yeah.
And very loving and very supportive both ways. And what that does to me is make all the conflict external. And mm-hmm. I think the conflicts in this movie are really weak, really lacking. Part of that has to do with the fact that Gavin O'Connor himself is one half of one of those conflicts. And I think he's a pretty weak actor. But I also think it's pretty derivative of other things I've seen. And I think the third act turn when Ava runs away is really out of nowhere and really unearned. And doesn't speak to the relationship that I saw within this movie. It doesn't speak to the maturity of the younger character, who I thought was very mature, or the obvious support you get from Janet McTeer's character, who is willing to leave men for her daughter, who is overjoyed when she hears she gets Juliet, and then even more overjoyed when she hears she got Romeo. The whole thing felt like a character study that forced a plot upon it. And to me, kind of wound up neither fish nor fowl for it.
I mean, I hear all of that, and I don't necessarily 100% disagree with you, but I'll say this. I think that this film really kind of won me over by the end. It kind of snuck up on me in a weird way, which I didn't really expect it to. You know, I watched it yesterday, and yesterday was a very emotional day for those who, if you know, we're timestamping this a little bit, but yesterday was inauguration day, and it was sort of, you know, there was a lot going on, and I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a little distracted in the first kind of half hour or so of the movie, just my mind being kind of all over the place. By the end of this film, I found myself surprisingly emotionally engaged in what was going on. I don't think this film is striving for the same levels of, and I mean, we're inevitably going to be comparing this to Anywhere But Here a fair amount, but I think that Anywhere But Here perhaps has loftier ambitions and is trying to do more. And I don't think this film has the same ambitions. I think that this film is trying to be smaller and more grounded. And messier in its own way. This isn't a studio movie. This is an independent movie. You know, Anywhere But Here feels like a big studio movie with two big movie stars, and it's slicker. It's got higher production value. It's got all sorts of stuff in its corner. You know, this is a movie that was made for $300,000. So this film is just striving for something different. You know, does it succeed entirely?
I don't know if that's true. That's mm-hmm. I don't know what it's striving for. Like I read a little bit about the story. I understand that Gavin O'Connor and his wife at the time, whose name is
Angela Shelton,
wrote it together based on her memories of her childhood. Mm-hmm. It seems quite derivative of other movies like this. It does not seem to be striving for anything different. It just seems like a low budget version. And it felt to me like the shaggy dogness of it was what it was trying to, sell to you. Almost cynically. I think that without the central performance from Janet McTeer, this movie would have been completely ignored. And she just happens to be the kind of actor who is she's spectacular. Like she's an amazing actor, and she could probably make almost anything watchable, which she kind of does. Like this movie only works because the two actors are really fucking strong.
Yeah.
But the daughter is really fucking strong. But there's almost nothing on the page, or there's nothing about the plot, or there's nothing about any kind of allegorical resonance going on here that I've could stick my teeth into.
I get that. I think it's spot on that this is definitely becomes a showpiece for Janet McTeer. But I think if you give Janet McTeer any space to do anything, she's just such an electrifying actor to watch. She has the best technique. She's classically trained. She's a stage actress. She knows how to just like draw you in. If you gave her enough space, she's going to make you watch her do anything. But yeah, I think perhaps what you're hitting on is that it doesn't feel like there's enough of a conflict maybe between her and between Mary Jo and Ava. I think that if Ava and her were maybe butting heads a little bit more, it would feel a little bit stronger, because it winds up feeling like the conflict is more like Mary Jo she's just always running from man to man to man to man. And so her conflict is really that she needs to like grow up, but it's almost like they needed to make her a little less mature and make Ava a little more mature, so that it's like, it is really like daughter taking care of mother and daughter finally putting her foot down and saying like, hey, you're supposed to raise me, and this is what's best for me, and you need to be the adult. And I think it's missing maybe a little bit of that. I appreciate kind of having more of a positive mother-daughter experience, because to me sometimes it feels like there's so many movies about like mothers and daughters absolutely like hating each other, and then they feel completely melodramatic and they go completely Mildred Pierce, which I love, by the way. I love when they're calling each other like trash. Like, I love that. Who doesn't love that? But it's like, this is not that kind of movie.
No.
And I appreciate having this like loving relationship at the center, but I think as you're saying, if the conflict is supposed to be more that Mary Jo is kind of this immature woman that needs to grow up and settle down, and she does eventually find this kind of grounding presence in this community and a grounding, an actual grounded adult man in J.O. Sanders' character, an actor that I also love. It's like, if she's going to find all that, then you also have to like... Yeah, you also have to like just make her a little more childish, and her daughter a little more mature, so that you have a little bit more of this like contrast between the two that I think is maybe more apparent in Anywhere
But Here. I think that's one way to do it for sure. I also don't necessarily have a problem with them, you know, being like the Gilmores, being like Laura.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that there's. I think that there's room for the idea that you have, or even, you know, they're not mother and daughter, but like Thelma and Louise. I think there's room for people to have a very strong central relationship, you know, go back to back with each other and just fight all comers. I think that the external forces here, with the exception of Noah Emmerich, who should have just been playing the Gavin O'Connor part, seem pretty tame. And the obstacles seem really low, and Mary Jo seems to overcome them very easily. So as a piece of like narrative filmmaking, it's flat. It's not necessarily a blanket indictment of the movie, because you could still do what I was hoping this movie would do, which is bring me somewhere. You know, I thought that we were going to get a road movie where I was going to go places and see things and experience things that I hadn't really experienced before. I thought the stuff on the road was pretty cool, but they were in California by like the 20 minute mark. And then the movie just stopped for me. So I was ready, Phil, I was going to text you like 20 minutes into the movie and just say like something like, fuck yeah, Tumbleweeds, it's great. Because I did think it was great for 20 minutes, but it really slowed down for me.
I found it real boring,
like from that point forward.
I hear that. I do. And listen, I'm not going to sit here and absolutely defend this movie because I think that I have issues with it as well. And obviously we'll talk about that. But I have to say that I guess I was just a little bit more charmed by it than you were, Kenning. You know this probably better than anybody, Kenny, that, you know, I don't need a lot of plot. I don't need a noisy movie just because, you know, and I'm not saying that you do, Kenny. I just think that, you know.
I like noisy movies. Don't get me wrong.
I can just sit with, a Before Sunrise or a Before Sunset where literally nothing happens and people just talk for 2 hours. That doesn't bother me.
But there are arcs in that movie. Characters change. That's not fair. Okay. That's not fair.
Let me finish. Okay. I hear where you're coming from and first of all, I would lay down in traffic for the Before trilogy. I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying that these films are equatable, but I want to just say that for me personally, the fact that this movie doesn't quote unquote do a lot, that to me just didn't bother me as much as perhaps it bothered you. Yeah. But I think that what I did find interesting, and this is where sort of the Gavin O'Connor thing comes in. I agree with you, Kenny. I don't think that Gavin O'Connor should have acted in this film, and there's a reason why he hasn't acted since. He's a much better director than he is actor. And there's any number of people that I think had he cast that role with a stronger actor, all of that storyline would have been upped in terms of just it.
It's crazy to me that they had Noah Emmerich for a scene.
And the role they used him in,
when Gavin O'Connor easily could have been the wife-beating boyfriend,
right.
and then just had a really strong actor like Noah Emmerich play that role.
Are they friends or something?
They are friends.
Okay, yeah. I was going to say because I know he's been in a couple of his.
Yeah, in the Americans, obviously.
It's not a badly written role. It's so overperformed. It's the scene in
underperformed. Weird.
Yeah, I find
it's
like it
times when it's really low and then really high.
Part I'm thinking is in the seafood restaurant.
When it's the diner.
It's almost too much for me. And I mean, I can see in my kind of log of the movie where I started saying things like, "This girl is fantastic. The art direction is so strong." To like, actually, I think this is really boring. So I don't know. I think that honestly, the Gavin O'Connor part, when he comes into the movie as a love interest, just stops it dead in its tracks. I don't disagree
that the casting of that role is problematic. It really throws the film off. He's not great. Had it been Noah Emmerich or somebody of a higher caliber of acting, I think perhaps we're talking about a different movie or at least a storyline that we're a little bit more engaged in. I'm not disputing any of that. What I think is interesting is that Gavin O'Connor, who has now sort of carved out a little bit of a lane for himself, making pretty overtly masculine sports movies, started his career with this small, overtly feminine movie about this mother and daughter, which he did, for all intents and purposes, pretty adroitly. Like all warts and all, I see this film for what it is, Kenny. I'm not saying that I don't, but that he has this arrow in his quiver in terms of being able to do something like this. I think it's surprising that he hasn't in any way sort of like, I'm thinking about the female characters that he's worked with or directed. And most of them short of Elizabeth Jennings in The Americans are kind of forgettable female characters. So it's just interesting that he made a film that for, you know, whether you like the film or not, has two very strong, solid performances and characters at its center. And I hope that he does something like that again in the future.
Yeah. And I guess my question is like, how much of that is coming from him and how much actually sure. came from Angela? Because yeah. obviously it was her story, her life that this was yeah. taken from. And I have to assume that some of these specificities that I mm-hmm. like are probably also coming from her, which is, again, not to say that men cannot write women in a specific yeah, way and in a way that I, as a woman, can't identify with and understand. There are plenty of men who have written wonderful female characters that have a lot of depth and a lot of specificity.
Sure.
But yeah, I think I wonder how much is coming from him and how much is coming from her. But then to have started his career with a movie like that, it is a little baffling as to why he hasn't tried to do anything yeah. sort of like that. And the last two movies he's made, by the way, have been with like Ben Affleck. And so it's like, yeah. you know, yeah. Pretty soon he'll probably direct him in a Dunkin' Donuts commercial. I don't know.
Here's hoping. I mean, I know that that's what Kenny would love to see.
But
you know, I love Ben Affleck.
I know you love
Ben Affleck. Yeah, I like Ben Affleck too. I just think it's... And then he did like Jane Got a Gun, which I never saw.
Yeah, kind of got weirdly buried. Yeah,
yeah, well, but then there again, it's like you have another kind of sort of woman-centric story for all I can tell.
This is true.
But it's like there's something sweet. You know, yeah. there's something sweet to tumbleweeds that's like, there's like a sweetness, there's a gentleness to it that I like. It has like that kind of rambling quality. And it makes me wonder why, you know, he hasn't wanted to go try something like that again. Maybe it's just that he needs that other female element. I don't know, I kind of
blanch at the framing of this as if this is a success. I understand that it's not offensive, which I appreciate. Well, I don't know why you're laughing. I don't think it's an appropriate response. I don't think it's an offensive portrayal of these characters, but I don't think that this is something that anybody should hold up as a great film or even a great film or even a great portrayal of these characters. I think that this is, like, to me, milquetoast, boring, not brave, with almost no incident, there's no emotional bravery here the way there was in Anywhere But Here. If anything, it does feel like it's, to me, made by a man, because it doesn't even dare consider the possibility that these characters are anything other than essentially saints. And I think he almost seems afraid to interrogate what's going on with these characters. That is really, really how I feel. I feel like there's a complete lack of emotional bravery and bravery when it comes to storytelling. I think this is very emblematic of some independent movies at the time, where the independentness of it is what gets by. And again, I do think, like, to some extent, Janet McTeer can, you know, play the phone book. I watch Ozark. I think she's unfucking believable in that show. I think she's amazing in Albert Nobbs. Like, she really, you know, I've never seen her on the English stage, but she's an amazing actor. But that alone is not enough for me to say this is a good film.
I mean, listen, the reason that I smiled earlier is to say that a film that made $1.3 million has 82% on Rotten Tomatoes and got an Oscar nomination, to say that's not a success, I think is perhaps unfair. I think that you might admit that you might not have liked
Wait, to say that it is a success just because other people like it is absurd. You should feel the way you feel about a movie. I don't care what Rotten Tomatoes says. I care what I think. And I don't think this is a success. And I'm making the point that isn't Rotten Tomatoes liked it. I am using I'm actually discussing the film instead of saying, well, you know, it made $1.3 million, therefore it's a success.
No. I hear you. First of all, I'm not dismissing what you're saying. I'm really just saying that I think that there were some people that liked the film. I didn't dislike the film as much as you did. And the fact that there are levels of success to this to some degree, I think it's a little bit unfair to say that Gavin O'Connor shouldn't ever attempt to.
You're missing the point. I don't care about the commercial success, and I don't care about the success from an aggregation of critics. I'm telling you why I didn't find this to be a successful movie, and I think it might speak to why other people haven't given Gavin O'Connor a movie like this in the future, because I don't think he was successful. However, that's speculation. What I know for sure is the way I feel. How do you feel about the movie? I don't care what kind of.
I think I've been pretty clear about it, but I understand.
Charming.
I think it's a better film. I certainly think it's a better film than you do. I think that you speak of a lack of emotional honesty. I think that the scene between Ava and forgive me, what is it? Don is his name. What's his name? Dan.
Yeah.
In the RV. I think it's a beautiful scene, and I think that Jay is tremendous in that scene.
I think it's a ridiculous scene. Could you imagine? It does speak to the power. It does speak to like Jay O'Sanders. That's his name, right?
Yeah.
Tremendous job. Tremendous mm-hmm. job with a monologue that in a vacuum is a winner. But put it in the context of delivering this monologue to a child that you hardly know in an RV that she stumbled into, where she stumbled into you for the third time this movie, it is absurd. The premise of this situation is absurd, and I can't divorce myself from how ridiculous that moment is. You have to earn moments like that. You can't just present a moment where this guy unloads on a 12-year-old that he killed his wife because he was a drunk driver and say that is emotion. That's not emotion. That moment was not earned. That moment was forced upon the audience in a very weird and awkward way.
Well, I guess, I mean, listen, we can have a larger discussion, and we might very well have it during this episode in terms of why something, why a scene exists and if it should exist. But, you know, the scene worked for me, you know, I was emotional watching the scene. So, you know, we can certainly argue about whether or not it was earned or not, but if it garners an emotional response, there's, you know, it's doing something right.
For me,
yes.
But I think you should interrogate why you felt the way you felt.
For me, I think it comes from a place of like, I think when you put him in contrast with these other men that like, He's kind of like the opposite end of these other men that Mary Jo has spent her life like running away from, right? Like he could have been those guys and kind of was, and he had to face an actual consequence for the choice that he made. So now he's like living with that choice. I understand feeling like this is kind of like absurd to unload it on a 12-year-old. It's a lot to unload on a kid, but also he spent enough time like around her and with her that I think he probably senses that she's like mature. I don't know. As to like the whether or not the movie is brave enough, I think also that problem can just be from when you're interrogating something that is so deeply personal to you, like, you know, like this is a story that is so personal to Angela. And I'm guessing that he perhaps gave more credence to her to like hash some of this stuff out and to like develop it how she wanted, because it's like her story. And he may not have wanted to push her to a different place, or she felt like she didn't want to push there. I think it's like some of that can just be from her. And at that point in her life, she felt like that was far enough, and there wasn't, she didn't want to take it farther, or maybe she didn't feel like it needed to be taken farther. I think like my thought is that it's like when something is sits too close to home, maybe you're not ready to go there. And then she made, you know, after that she made like a documentary about her life and the abuse that she went through and living in foster homes, and that, which I have not seen, to me sounds like a much deeper interrogation of things that she went through. And this is kind of a nice thing. And part of me wonders if this would have been a story that would have been better on stage, because you have a couple really strong characters, and I think it's something you could very easily adapt to the stage, where again, Janet McTeer would just tear it up and would probably have a Tony for it. You know, you could make it a two character play or a two character with one man who plays all these other roles, and it could be a great play.
You're hitting on, you bring up a lot of interesting points. You're hitting on a lot of interesting things. I mean, she doesn't owe the audience anything except for her best attempt at doing a good job, whatever that is.
Right.
Right? All she owes is her best attempt at telling whatever the story is she wants to tell in whatever way, save for Gavin O'Connor. So I'm not presupposing that she held back on us. What I'm saying is, if this is the story that they wanted to tell in this way, this, if you set it alongside every other film in the history of cinema, feels very derivative of so many films I felt. Now, I could speculate that in the absence of the real details you're talking about that sound harrowing, they substituted tropes and things that we've seen before that to me left me pretty cold. But yeah, they can tell whatever story they want to tell. I just don't think there was anything new or interesting here. And and with regards to the Dan character, I didn't like that for a lot of reasons. I didn't like that character for a lot of reasons. I don't like the idea that it doesn't, again, you go whatever direction you want to go in. And maybe her mother in real life did finally find, you know, solace with a good man. That is not a particularly satisfying ending in general. To have someone who is with a succession of abusive men to find a good man. That's not a victory to me. He also strikes me, and this is going to sound a little weird, but like as a manic pixie dream boy, because he's too good to be true. He has almost no character throughout the movie, except for he's vaguely nice and can quote Shakespeare, but he just stands in contrast to the other assholes, but he doesn't do anything. And then I really found the RV scene with the confession to just be really emotionally manipulative and apropos of nothing. So that's really how I feel. Phil, how do you feel?
I mean, this is not a film that I feel particularly passionate about or one that I'm going to, you know, deeply ride for here. I think, you know, listen, you're obviously, you know, you feel the way you feel about it. I think you're being a little harsh. That's just me personally. I don't think that the film is.
You could engage with it. You don't have to just say, "Oh, you feel the way you feel." Like,
well, listen, man. I think that we've, you know, this is a small independent movie that was made in sort of the heyday of independent cinema, or at least a different heyday of independent cinema in '99. I think that this film has the best of intentions. And it is successful in some regards and unsuccessful in others. I think that you can see a lot of Gavin O'Connor's abilities, or what he starts to hone on his craft a little bit in this film, in terms of, you know, I appreciated the handheldness of it, the groundedness of it. I liked the messiness of the relationships and of quite frankly, just some of the way that the scenes actually played out. They weren't clean and slick. It's one of my issues with Anywhere But Here, which is that I think that film ultimately, I liked the film. Rochelle Lefebvre was unbelievably effective at, if you ever listen to the episode, I mean, it's like a therapy session for Kenny and I. In terms of tapping into
we have to stop the episode at some point.
You had to really cry. Yeah.
We had a moment. So,
because the movie is about emotional abuse. The movie is about being imprisoned by your parents.
Sure.
And I'm not saying that's what every movie has to be about. And like these movies really aren't the same, except for it's about, you know, mother and a daughter who essentially travel from one place to another. And the mother seems to be in search of a husband. But mm-hmm. the mothers are very different from the daughters. I'm sorry, the mothers are different from each other. The daughters are different from each other. The relationships are different from each other. They're not similar movies. I think the first question I had when I expected to like this was basically, I think people who don't know anything about these two movies except what they've heard, except the imprint they've made on the collective consciousness.
Yeah.
Assume that Tumbleweeds is a success and Anywhere But Here is a failure. And I think that's borne out with things like, I'm sure Anywhere But Here made more money, but I'm sure it had, you know, kind of a lower percentage.
Yeah.
And Tumbleweeds had the Oscar nomination for Jonathan McTeer, and Tumbleweeds is 82%. And I'm pretty confident Anywhere But Here was under 50%. My question was, which movie would you rather be? Because when you said, and Phil, I don't mean to like just call you out, but when you said, you know, when you led your defense of it with, it's an independent movie. I don't care about that. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there paying the same amount of money to sit in the theater, and I expect something that's exhibited to me in a theater to be excellent, or I hope it will be excellent. I've seen plenty, we all have seen plenty of movies made for under $500,000 that are incredible. So it's not, I don't think it deserves bonus points for being made for less money. And on top of that, I'm pretty confident that this movie benefited from the fact that it was made for less money, because I do think that people give independent films sometimes the benefit of the doubt that you don't get when you have Susan Sarandon and Natalie Portman star the movie.
I mean, I think both of these films were aimed at similar demographics. I think that, I think that just looking at Anywhere But Here, you know, 64% on Rotten Tomatoes, certainly not the worst score, made $23 million on a $23 million budget. Like, no one lost their shirt on that movie. I'm not sitting here saying that those are metrics with which we should be garnering, you know, success or failure. But my point...
Tumbleweeds exists and Anywhere But Here doesn't.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I mean,
ish.
I mean, I mean, truthfully, like Tumbleweeds, both of these movies feel like they don't really exist to me. And I would argue that it might be because I'm a man and that these movies weren't really necessarily aimed at me. They're both kind of Oscar baity movies in their own way. Getting an Oscar nomination. But I guess my ultimately where I come down on this movie, just to be completely above board, is that is it a movie I'm ever going to watch again? No. Is it a movie that is going to stay with me? Probably not. Did by the end of the film, did I find myself more emotionally engaged with it than I expected to be, considering the subject matter and the various things that Kenny's talked about? Yes. Did the Dan character work for me? Sure. Am I a sucker for tropes? Probably. Like I'm not trying to be dismissive of the strikes you have against it, Kenny, because I think they're completely valid. I just don't think that they necessarily hit me as hard as they hit you. But I also will say, as I sort of prefaced all of this, you know, did this movie have my full attention, or was I thinking about the future of this country for most of the time that I was watching it? Yeah. I mean, I don't know. So it's just, and again, like, you know, I agree with what you're saying, Kenny, in terms of the relationship between Susan Sarandon and Natalie Portman versus Mary Jo and Ava in this. This film has very low stakes. The relationship between them is not nearly as fractured, isn't nearly as broken, isn't nearly as tense, and just doesn't have the levels of depth that the relationship has in Anywhere But Here. And it's worse off for it, for sure.
Then I am, as a viewer, and this is really why I kind of have, like, I gave a very bad grade. This is really why I crossed over from a movie that is fine to a movie that I really dislike, because I feel like in the third act, when you have something as rash and dangerous as Ava running away, preceded by almost nothing that would make you think that that's a possibility for this character, I feel like they're trying to manipulate me, and I think that it's kind of unfair.
Sure. Or it's that, like, it could also be that, like, you have to do something that dramatic because your mother is not going to get it otherwise. It's like, maybe her mother would not have understood that, like, there's a fucking consequence to, like, not growing up. Like this daughter is, like, screaming to have some roots anywhere. So, like, it makes sense to me that you might do something that is completely, like, seems completely wild. I don't know that it's, like, completely out of character, because she's 12, and, like, the first thing a 12-year-old is going to think to do to get their parents' attention is to, like, go AWOL and, like, well, you're not paying attention to me, so I'll make sure you never pay attention to me again. You know, I think that's like to me a normal thing for a kid to just be like, well, I'm just gonna, like, disappear and you'll never hear from me again. But you know, I think that it could be, like, I agree that it does feel, based on their relationship that we've built up to that point, it does feel a little bit like, whoa, she just, like, ran out on her. They don't have this, like, emotionally abusive relationship. They have, by all accounts, like, a pretty good understanding relationship. She's able to, like, call her mom out on stuff in, like, a joking way, and her mother takes it very well.
Yeah.
And so it does feel a little out of left field, but I think for me, I also agree that if somebody else other than Gavin O'Connor had played that role and really built up, like, how shitty of a dude this guy was, and that Ava's just like, I've had enough. Like, I'm tired of doing this. We go through this same routine over and over again. Which, by the way, I have to mention that the place that's supposed to be Missouri in the movie looks nothing like Missouri anywhere in Missouri. It is clearly, like, New Mexico, and it's driving me crazy. So that is my one really major dislike. It's the same problem that I had with Sharper you know, what was it?
Sharp Objects.
Because Gillian Flynn, she is from Kansas City, Missouri, and that fucking show was shot in Atlanta, Georgia, and I knew it the whole time because it didn't look like Missouri, and no one in Missouri has an accent that sounds like, oh, Scarlet Fiddle-Dee-Dee. Like, no one sounds like that in Missouri. Literally no one sounds.
What's so weird about that show is it was clearly in Missouri because they clearly said it several times. But if you asked me where it was filmed or where it was set, I think I would have said Georgia.
And it was filmed in Georgia.
Because No. I didn't mean film. Set. If you ask me where it was set.
Yeah. Sure.
Because you're right. It's so confused. It's internally confused.
They made it a Southern Gothic. And I was like, first of all, yes. Missouri's not a Southern state. The boot heel is basically Southern. But I don't think about them. No one cares.
Are there like plantation homes there? Like,
not really. I mean, I thought it was in Savannah.
That's where my brain went.
Yeah,
I mean, that's like Savannah.
Yeah, but anyway, the point is that the scene in Tumbleweeds that's supposed to be in Missouri looks nothing like Missouri. It's clearly like outside of New Mexico or wherever. Yeah. And I was like, okay, come on. Y'all could have done. There's plenty of locations in California that you can make look like Missouri. But yeah, I think the point is that like if I'd had more, I think if you put a different, you know, not like a Sam Rockwell, but somebody that has that like more explosive energy that would have made me feel like, wow, this guy is really like.
Well, it also, you know, what it robs you of, Kenny, and it's something you mentioned to sort of piggyback on what you were saying earlier, it robs you of danger, quite frankly.
There's just not enough danger in it.
It robs you of stakes and sort of a tension and a crackle that the movie desperately needed. So I you know, it's unfortunate. My assumption is he cast himself for budget purposes, which is that he. But
well, there's more danger in the trailer, frankly. From like,
yes, from yes.
The first half of the trailer makes it seem like, I don't know, fucking Hillbilly Elegy or something, like a movie I also have not seen. So I like Ron Howard, but I love the two actresses, but I won't.
Yeah,
I'm not going to watch. But there's way more danger in the trailer because you get all this like stuff with her like fighting the Noah Emmerich character and all, and you're like, this is like, I don't know, backwards Winter's Bone or something, and like with like Alice doesn't live here anymore, and I'm like, great, I'm on board, and then you watch it and you're kind of like, oh well, you need a little more of that danger all the way through, and all these guys, I think we needed more information about all these different men
too. The danger is a big element that we're missing.
Yeah, I think that's it.
But the other element that we're missing is, I can't imagine, for instance, that they thought that what they were writing was dangerous. But I do think what they thought they were writing was desperate. And I feel like they thought they were writing desperation over and over again. Now, I'm not saying I need desperation, but it seemed like that's what they were playing. Mm-hmm. Yet at every turn, the as I said earlier, the obstacles were so low and it was so easy for them to overcome them that I never truly felt like these characters were at any sort of real risk. I mean, wild tangent I'm about to throw at you, but this morning I watched two episodes of The Conners, and The Conners, by the way, the first two
America's
episodes
favorite
of the season,
show.
That's a good show.
Yeah, I've heard it's a good show.
It is a good show. Now it takes place in the pandemic, and in the first episode, like they're in the, and this is the first episode I've ever seen of the show. I mean, I've obviously seen Roseanne, but I just threw it on because I thought it would be safe for my child. it's in the pandemic, and John Goodman gets an eviction notice. And I am immediately feeling, all right, so they're in the pandemic. The Land for Lunchbox is struggling. Like, restaurants are shutting down. All this horrible stuff is happening and they're getting evicted in 5 days. That's fucking danger and desperation.
Yeah.
I don't know how the Conners are
going to
get
baby.
Out of this. Hey, don't. And it's not like, you know, there's no one coming and killing anybody. There's no one. There's no murder on the loose. There's no abuse. There's just something clear. And I don't know how they're going to get out of it. I never felt like that with this family because she got the first job she applied for.
Yeah.
She went out. She met a guy. She met a guy on the side of the road and then ran into him again in a bar.
Yeah.
Everything was just – it was – so again, all of these decisions aren't deadly. But if you're going to make the movie like this, you have to give me something else which is elevated. And the movie, to me – again, I thought when I said the art direction was so good, which I think the art direction was quite good, Ava's bedroom was awesome.
Yeah.
Like that bedroom was so evocative in a way that it felt like a 12-year-old's bedroom, but didn't feel like every other 12-year-old's bedroom.
Yeah.
That I really loved. Like, and I thought that's what we were getting, which is like, this feels like a mother-daughter relationship we've seen before, this feels like a real mother-daughter relationship, but not like every other one. And to me, in the end, it felt like every other one on a smaller budget with a worse actor, you know, sitting across the table.
Yeah, I mean, I it's interesting you bring up the Ava thing because as I'm sort of in my brain going back through the movie as to the stuff that stayed with me, most of it is the Ava stuff. It's not the Mary Jo stuff. I think the Lois Smith scenes are nice because I think Lois Smith is a very good actress.
Yeah.
And this isn't to take anything away from Jenic Mateer. I guess I only felt sort of – there's that one scene she has after Ava runs away with her friend.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of breaks down a little bit and you finally feel like the armor has come down a little bit and you're seeing sort of the sheer tonnage of shit that this woman has sort of pushed down for however many years, which I thought again is a really nice moment. I'm not sitting here saying that these nice moments all coalesce into a great film. I'm merely saying that like the you know, Ava going on a date with her boyfriend and not remembering to breathe, which by the way, is something that I also did when I was a teenager. So I empathize with that situation.
Sure.
But I you know, those little moments of Ava's sort of and then the Auntie Rose, I think was their euphemism for menstruation, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Which again was a nice moment that led to a scene that, yes, we've seen iterations of it before, but I thought it was executed quite well between the two of them. They felt very they felt real to me to some degree or another.
They felt real too.
Yeah.
And a big part of that is because Kimberly Brown really did a great job.
Like
she, and it's not the dialogue isn't bad. The dialogue isn't embarrassing.
Yeah.
Her naturalistic acting was truly like incredible. Like I really did like, you know, and what's weird is like, I could see me in the end of this, like 52, like putting her on our best supporting because I loved her performance despite the fact that I thought almost everything she did was like boring and tropey. I've seen so many movies with a kid in it where it ends with that kid in a play. Yeah. I've seen so many movies in it where the kid in it, where it ends with a kid with that play with Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
I've seen so many first kisses between kids that don't seem like they'd be kissing. Not that these two wouldn't kiss each other, but I was looking up this child's age because I thought she was like 8, right? I didn't know that she was 12. Like 12 is, I mean, I guess you can kiss when you're 12, but like they seem like little. I mean, I guess you could, but they seem like little kids.
Yeah,
I think that it's interesting because as you were talking, I was thinking about Ava in the RV scene with Dan at the end. And I don't disagree with you, Kenny, that like they're gilding the lily with what they do with Dan in terms of like, you know, they go too far with it. And I think they could have definitely pulled back and hit the same thing. What Ava's doing in that scene, I think, is actually kind of special. You know, the idea of Ava being like, well, I guess we're fucking leaving town again. Like, I guess this shit's, you know what I mean? Like we've hit another wall and mom's going to drag us out of town again. The emotional kind of weight that this child is under because of her mother, I felt that in that scene. And for me, that made that scene sing more so. As good as J.O. is in the scene, and I think he is quite good in the scene, even if, like I said, it goes too far. It's just, I don't know, that type of stuff felt, that resonated with me, that kind of worked for me in one way or another. But you were going to say something, Emmy?
Oh, sorry, go ahead, Emmy.
Oh, no, I was thinking again about, like, this idea of, like, desperation, and I think I keep bringing this up, but it's just the movie that I keep thinking that it wants to be, which is Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, right? Where you've got a mother, right? Where you've got a mother who is at her wit's end. She's leaving her husband, who was abusive to her, emotionally abusive, certainly, has died, and she's dragging her kid, who annoys the hell out of her, to like town to town, and you feel that desperation of she cannot get a job. She can't get a job singing here. She can't get a job singing here. She has to take a job as a waitress. Nobody likes her. She hates her life. Her kid is driving her crazy, telling her the same joke over and over and over again. And like at every moment, you just feel Ellen Burstyn like, She is like frustrated. She is at her wit's end. She loves the kid to pieces, though. She does love him to pieces, but she is like, she is also just like, I gotta make this work for my kid. I gotta get money. I gotta figure out a life. But also, I have dreams. I have things I want to do, and I don't love it either. That like at the end of that movie. Look, we all get the allure of 70s Kris Kristofferson.
Who doesn't want a young Kris Kristofferson?
Who doesn't want to wind up with Kris Kristofferson in the 70s, even in A Star Is Born, where Barbra Streisand puts glitter over his eyebrows in a bathtub? Who doesn't want that? But, like, I don't love either that movie then ends with her having gone from, like, this abusive husband to this other guy who slapped her kid, by the way. Yeah. People love to forget that. She winds up with this guy. I think the ending of Tumbleweeds is a little more ambiguous as to whether or not Mary Jo kind of winds up with Dan. It's, like, moving in that direction. But, like...
Was it? Yeah, I wanted to ask you guys, because I found the ending a little confusing, right?
I think it's a very confusing ending.
Right? He leaves the picture, he smiles, then he gets in his RV... And then we have no inclination that he didn't leave town.
It's hard to say.
It gets a little vague.
It's very vague. It just ends. It's like The Sopranos. You're like, what? They're talking about tampons.
Like The Sopranos.
It's like The Sopranos of menstruation, because it just they're talking about tampons and he leaves the photo over. And then it's like boop, the end.
Yeah. Emmy, the with a freeze frame in 1999.
Yep.
The comparison to Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore really puts into kind of focus.
Stark focus how Stark bad this movie is.
Yeah, which is hard because it's Scorsese, you know, it's hard. It is Scorsese. And to me, it's one of my favorites of his. And it's always one of the ones I hold up when people make the bullshit argument that he is bad for women, because I'm like, he's not. Like, there's so many instances of him not, but which is that could be a different podcast on its own. But like, it is just the stakes are, there's so much more danger to that whole situation. She's also dealing with abusive men. She's dealing with a kid. The kid is less memorable in that movie to me. But all of those characters are people that I really want to know more about. I feel like I know who they are. Like, I know who Kris Kristofferson's character is in that movie, what kind of man he is, what he wants, what he doesn't want, what he likes for breakfast. I know everything about Diane Ladd's character, who she is. I don't know anything about Mary Jo's friend in this movie, other than she's getting married, you know. I understand what you mean is like there's like a lot of missing information, and I don't always need to have like 25 pages of backstory on every single character. Obviously, you know, it's like I don't always need all that, and I'm fine with like a character study, you know, or a movie like Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women, where it's just kind of these nice vignettes that like there's some I like more than others.
I love that movie.
The strength of that movie is in the Kristen Stewart vignette with there's a lot more tension. And so it's like, I need a little more tension. And so I totally get, Kenny, I totally get where you're coming from. Cause I think the movie, it just does not have the danger and the precariousness and the, like, the actual desperation of Alice doesn't live here anymore, where when you get to the ending of that, I do feel really much more like, oh, like, wow, we really did get somewhere with these people. And you're right. I don't feel that necessarily with Tumbleweeds. I think, like, yeah, this is a nice movie. It's a movie that I would put on my letterboxed list of, like, mid-budget mother-daughter movies that I enjoy, that I think people should check out and compare and contrast.
What you've done, Emmy, is, like, really pull it. You've kind of finished, like, the sentence for me in a way, because you hit on something that I think is, like, this movie's final and fatal flaw. Alice Doesn't Live Here is told from the point of view of Ellen Burstyn.
Yep.
Yeah. Anywhere But Here is told from the point of view of Natalie Portman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whose point of view is this movie told from?
Yeah, I mean, as you were ramping up here, I was just like, I mean, I think if you asked Gavin O'Connor, he would probably say Ava. But I don't think it's clear. Desperately. It's
not. I think that's the whole thing. It's not very clear.
You don't need an answer to that question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You don't need an answer to that question.
Yeah.
But I do think if you asked 100 people who watched the movie,
yeah,
50 would say Mary Jo and 50 would say Ava. Yeah. And I think so that's part of the problem right there.
Yeah.
That because it's not clear which of these two people is our protagonist, it's not clear which of these two people is our dilemma, right? Yep. And that is the big fucking issue with this movie. Yep. Because what you, as I said, you finished the sentence, you really made me realize, like, all right, Alice Doesn't Live Here is, to me, brilliant because it actually feels like having a kid. Right? Like, having a kid is the greatest thing in the world and you would do anything for it, but it is fucking hard work. All right? Sure. There's nothing about Ava that's hard work until the end. She's a dream child.
It's true. It's true.
On the flip side, Anywhere But Here is told from Natalie Portman's perspective. And she is, in her own way, a dream child. But her dilemma is her mother. Her dilemma is, my mother is a cancer on my life.
Yeah.
And mentally unstable in, like, a toxic way.
Yes. Yeah. And what do I do? And the end of that movie is beautiful and brilliant because she leaves her. Yep. Like, not in a, like, I'm leaving you forever kind of way, but, like, I am actually strong enough to go out on my own despite your wishes.
Yeah.
This movie doesn't have a protagonist. Therefore, it doesn't have a protagonist problem. Therefore, it doesn't have
an antagonist. Or an antagonist.
It doesn't. And that's the thing, is it doesn't really have a clear, strong antagonist. And I think, like, we're supposed to think that the Gavin J. O'Connor character is our antagonist. And he is at one point. But, like, she already seems over him by the time she starts dating him. Like, you look at her face and it's, like, clear when she sees him on the side of the road. She's like, ah, yeah, like, this guy seems like somebody I would want to sleep with, but, like, as soon as they actually start dating, it's like, you're so over him. Like, there's nothing, I can't find anything reason why you're, like, attracted to him, really. Like, I think you needed an actor that just has a little more magnetism, a little more, and I don't even, I'm thinking in 1999, like, who that would be, like, who would be cheap enough?
It's like Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah,
there are these guys are all over the place. It's like,
you know,
Chaz Palminteri. It's like these guys, that guy exists all over the place. The character I wanted to watch, and I wish we got, was the one who was like, this guy was in love with me in high school. He'll never stop being obsessed with me. I can go there. Yeah. I can get him back. and I can live off his like used car salesman money. That is like, that's a character. That is someone who has like this bizarre drive. She has a weird plan for her daughter. She's willing to go to a weird situation. By the way, she's right. High school love never does die. Like if he was in love with her in high school and he singled out, he would have dropped it all 100%. And there's a movie there. But this movie is not like, like that scene was unnecessarily cruel, where she just backed off right away.
Yeah, I thought that too.
And we lost potentially the most interesting, you know.
Well, I think it's I think there's something interesting to Mary Jo's sort of relentless shark kind of quality. This idea of her sort of going from one person to another, to like just this, the devouring of relationships, the relentlessness of her, I think is interesting. I don't think it's weaponized particularly well.
No.
And I don't think that they really kind of dig into the emotional fallout of that. Well, but there's some, I've met those type of people and I think there's something interesting there. But like Susan Sarandon in Anywhere But Here is legitimately like mentally unstable and has like serious psychological problems.
She's also a cruel person, right?
Like there's dimension to her that Mary Jo doesn't have.
Yeah, I like the idea of this, like, you know, I love a relentless woman. In some ways, in my own life about certain things, I think I am relentless, and I think women have to be relentless oftentimes to get anywhere, right? I think for me, Mary Jo is like, she comes off a little bit like a budget Blanche DuBois. Like she's a little bit of a budget, you know, a little bit of a budget Tennessee Williams character, right? She loves these like 1950s cut dresses and hats. And she has this real, like, even though she's from North Carolina, she has this real like Southern, you know, Southern melodramatic bell thing going on, that like in the 50s, you know, like you can watch any movie from the 50s is going to have like a character like this, but it's, she feels like an unfinished Tennessee Williams character. Really. It's like there's something that's a little bit tragic about her, but she loves magic, and we're supposed to just, you know,
she almost feels like a shitty American version of a Mike Lee character in a weird way. There's something sort of, but again, like you guys said something that really stuck with me. Both of you sort of hit on this, like the desperation component and lack thereof. Like, Kenny, when you were talking about like the Connors and that the palpable sense of something foreboding, something is barreling down on us, and we have to fix something. There's none of that in this film, because to your point, Kenny, it's all too easy, right? Like there's very little conflict in this film, and there's very little obstacles. It's kind of neither fish nor fowl, right? Like it wants some things and it wants other things, but it never fully actually commits to a lot of stuff.
I think that's what it is. Yeah. And I think just back to kind of my number one first feeling was that this movie's not brave. I don't think like the movie that Emmy was kind of pitching, the idea of a relentless woman is great, and I do feel like she could be that. My issue with kind of the narrative arc as it is that she just doesn't, she's not at fault, right? She's not at fault. So what does she have to learn? What is she like, what has she really done wrong here, except for like stand up for herself, except for leave bad situations, right? Like she leaves her job because she's being sexually harassed. Like I don't feel like she has, I feel like she really is about the best version of the character she could be from the onset of the movie, given the set of cards she was dealt.
Right. But she doesn't quite go through. It's like, I like a relentless woman, and I also think that there are probably ways, there are more, obviously there need to be more ways we show how desperate she is, and it can't be so easy, but it's also that, like, when you get stuck in an abusive cycle and making, or even just making the same cycle of toxic choices over and over again, like, I think that's something that Fleabag does really well, is like, this is a woman that keeps making these same choices over and over and over again, and it is like entertaining to watch, but it also is very painful for her, and she's trying to like work through some shit, and I never really, you don't get that sense from Mary Jo, because you're right, she's like, she immediately leaves her boss who's like sexually harassing her, she leaves all of these relationships, she may stay in them for a while, but they don't really investigate like why. Yeah. It's like we need to, it's almost like they should have just picked, not that I always want to watch women be abused all the time, because there's like plenty of that out there too, but it's like for story purposes, I think I agree that the idea of that like car salesman thing, that would be a really interesting movie, and she has to stay there for a while and figure it out. It's almost like you gotta figure out how to like work through those issues, and we don't really understand what her issues are to work through, other than being someone who is a serial monogamist who just like runs through men, and that's how she like makes her money. Yeah. And so if you do that, then she needs to end up alone, probably, because you need to like learn to stand on your own two feet, especially as a woman. And if she's like relentless enough, she like needs to like stand up for herself. But like, yeah, it just feels like she keeps making a lot of the same choices, right? This cycle. But I don't get a sense of how it's like actually hurting her or affecting her, because she immediately leaves all of the problems, which she should do, right? She should do. But like, yeah, there's no like, we don't get a sense of like why, like, Alice doesn't live here anymore. When she leaves Harvey Keitel's character, it's because he's gonna beat the shit out of her and maybe kill her if she stays, and she's like, oh well, this is no better than the one I was in before, I gotta just not be with men. And then she meets Chris Christopherson, who is a little different.
But you have to get, so you, but that's, I'm not saying it has to be this arc every time, but you, that's the arc.
Because
the thing that, like,
I'm with you. We're like getting somewhere. Yeah. We're like getting somewhere.
I feel like what's like, yeah, I feel like what I'm coming to as you speak is this idea of like, she keeps making like quote unquote the wrong choices, but not really, because like, what was the red flag that she should have seen with Gavin O'Connor? I would say there were none. This guy had a job. He treated her really respectfully on the side of the road, even though she was coming on to him. He seemed like a very normal guy. He was nice to the daughter in the beginning. There were no red flags with this guy. So that wasn't a bad decision in and of itself. It turned out to be a bad decision. Now, if it turned out to be a bad decision, I do think that there is certainly a wide enough berth to make the point that men are trash, which men are often trash. Yeah. If you're going to take the opinion that men are trash, there's only one way, but you are still going to be a heterosexual woman who's looking to potentially be in a relationship with one of these trash men. The only way is to fix yourself.
Yeah.
To put yourself in a position where you are confident enough to leave when the man in question reveals his true nature to be a trash man, which I think Dan might do at some point. I think that's the idea. But she never really does work on herself. She never really gets to that point where she says, I'm enough. I'm me. It's me and my daughter. We're good. And then, because I think that's what happens and Alice doesn't live here anymore, right? I think at some point she says, I can do it. And once you say, I can do it, then whatever happens, happens. But if Chris Christopherson leaves her life next time, she's going to be okay because she could stand on her own 2 feet.
Yeah.
So again, I don't want her to be abused. And I don't
mind
the idea of like, I don't mind the idea that like Gavin O'Connor is kind of a stealth abuser, or it's not even really that. He's just kind of a difficult
person. He's kind of a stick in the mud.
He sucks. He just kind of sucks.
Yeah.
He sucks.
I don't know. I mean, she really, really would have been helped. Again, she got the job at the nursery at the end, and there is something like kind of building there, the idea that
she would and it seems like she would be really happy there. But again, it's like we don't really get any information. Like, why is she so good with plants? Why does she love plants so much? This is something that can the symbolism is right that you when you plant something, you're like putting roots down, right? Yeah. But like, I mean, like it's just there's a lot of like.
Can I just say, pieces. I gotta say that you guys have really opened my eyes to how bad this movie is.
I thought this movie was bad until like, and I don't know that I think it's bad. I just think now that I'm thinking about it more, like
it's just not fully realized. I think
I think it has a lot of potential. But it's not.
I feel similarly to you that I don't think this is necessarily a bad movie. I think this is a movie that needed more work. This is a script that needed more drafts. It's just not there yet. And you know, who knows? They got a script and maybe they got it to Janet McTeer, whatever the case might be, and they got a movie made. So
they made the whole, you know, the movie that weirdly reminded me of.
Yeah.
Was Aaron Brockovich. But only the boring parts of Aaron Brockovich.
Well, I find no parts of Aaron Brockovich boring, but that's mostly just me because I love it to pieces.
You're not wrong because Aaron Brockovich is amazing. Like I didn't want to say only the boring parts because I think the relationship she has with Aaron Eckhart is amazing.
Yeah. But it's not as interesting as the other stuff
happening. No, and it's a B plot, and there really aren't, you know, your ups and downs in that plot. And I think that it really helps in light of what she's doing in the rest of that movie that, of all things, this like bizarre looking biker, construction worker man is the one who like grounds her at home. I love that about the movie.
Yeah.
But like, you can't make a movie about just Aaron Brockovich and Aaron Eckhart finding some tranquil bliss together. But like, not only that, like he's a trucker and is boring looking instead of like a guy who looks like he's going to kick your ass, but turns out to be a sweetheart.
Yeah.
Can I also just want to say, because the Aaron Brockovich parallel is a very good one, because I think what Aaron Brockovich does is all the things that obviously this film is striving for, in the sense of Aaron Brockovich has some wonderful small moments. I mean, Steven Soderbergh is obviously a phenomenally talented filmmaker, but little silent moments, little things like Aaron Eckhart calling her in the middle of the night to tell her that her daughter said her first word. You know what I mean? And the radiance of Julia Roberts' star wattage in that scene, she doesn't have to say anything. She's just crying and smiling and laughing. And it's just like the host of emotions that film is able to convey in 15 seconds is obviously unreal. And this film wishes that it had that ability. It doesn't. But, you know, it's you're not wrong that they're traveling in somewhat similar currency. They're just... one is infinitely better than the other.
It would have been a fine place to start for a B story in a movie that was about something else. Mm-hmm. And that's you know, so when I say like, you know, I don't even think that it's a flawed movie unrealized. Like, I just think I don't know. I take a much more cynical look at this movie, which feels like I feel like it was a late 90s indie movie that was riding the wave of better movies that came before it.
I don't disagree with any of that.
Had the veneer of a lot of those movies that came before it. I also want to say, like, I like a lot of Kevin O'Connor's movies. And I think Warrior is as good as a fucking movie, you know, good as a sports movie gets. So, like, the guys...
You like Miracle, too, don't you? Didn't you like Miracle?
Of course I like Miracle. Like, Miracle's amazing. And
I like Warrior, The Way Back, quite frankly. Like,
The guy can direct. It's not that he can't. And his first movie made for $500,000 is not necessarily a fair assessment of his abilities.
His acting abilities, maybe, though.
But it's just this movie just didn't do it for me. And you know, especially having done what we've done, like 160 of these, 170 of these now. and having seen so many like phenomenal lead performances by female actors, it does kind of like, you know, irk me that this somehow broke through the noise when like it could have been Sarah Polley and Guinevere, you know? Yeah. So like, it's, you know, that kind of thing.
Or it could have been, I mean, listen, Kenny and I every year do an Oscars for the year of movies that from 99. And I mean, the litany of overlooked great female performances in 99 is pretty shocking. So there's,
sure.
It's well, unfortunate.
It's kind of, it's just like, why, you know, why has Janet McTeer not really been on people's radars? It's a problem that I have talked to a couple of my other female
clearly
writer
you haven't
friends
seen Albert Nobbs.
Well, okay, but well, like
I'm interested in this.
I mean it's not a new discussion point, but it's just a discussion point about how like we just continually fail these incredible actresses who are over a certain age, but especially like, I mean, Janet McTeer is almost 60, but like basically these women over 50, but really kind of a little over 40, because I think about like Sarah Paulson, who is stuck in Ryan Murphy land for who knows how long. And it's like these women who they're just not getting roles worthy of them or like they're underwritten and, you know, or you have like people like Meryl, who is amazing, but she's always the first phone call for any of these roles. And then it's like Jessica Lange has talked about this. She's like, you know, they're going to call Meryl first. They're not going to call me. And then you got like someone like Janet McTeer, who's like a fantastic British actress who could have been like a Cate Blanchett and you could throw her in anything. And she's like incredible. But she's like, I don't know if it's just that she prefers like stage work, because a lot of English actors like to just do stage work and do, you know, do some stuff here and there. And she's had some good TV roles for sure. But like, this is an actress that it's like, where have you been? Like, why is Hollywood not like busting the door down to like get you in more things? Because she has a lot of range and she can do so much stuff. And like, obviously she's worked with Glenn, who is another like actor's actor. Glenn Close really, you know, really is and could also be hired for more things instead of like doing a lot of melodramatic stuff like The Wife. You know, it's just like, I want better for these women. Like it makes
I'm looking, it's interesting. I'm looking at her.
It makes me angry.
And it is really interesting. It's like, you know, so she does this in 99. She gets, you know, she gets an Oscar nomination and essentially follows it up with pretty much nothing. And that's not a knock on her. You know, she does some television. But it's like Albert Nobbs, I think, did she got some award recognition for that or some nomination.
She was nominated for that as well. It's like,
I'm
going to answer the question and the answer is going to be bad. It's going to be an indictment of the industry.
Yeah, I mean, of course. Like
as it should be.
But my answer is good, I think. The short answer is Hollywood fucked up. Like that's to me that's the short answer. Like I think people would look back now and say what you just said, which is we could have done a lot more with this actress. Yeah. The longer answer is, to me at least, she is not a traditional leading lady.
Right.
Yeah.
And she is a screen presence that I think a lot of male actors and probably a lot of male directors and probably a lot of male producers were intimidated by.
Right.
You know, that's put to incredible use in Ozark. I don't know. Emmy, did you watch Ozark?
I don't. My parents love it, and actually they shoot – or when they would shoot on location, a lot of that shot about 50 minutes from where I grew up, because it's set at Lake of the Ozarks, and that is literally 50 minutes from my house. I don't think they shoot a lot of it there, just some maybe like exterior stuff at this point. But my parents adore Ozark. Love her.
It's a parent show. Like, there's no question about it. But I think it's gotten legitimately great, right? I think the first two seasons are like Showtime type stuff, and I think it's really worked its way into Breaking Bad territory, and I'm quite impressed. And that coincides with her coming into the show because she's such a different presence. She basically plays the Mexican drug gang's American lawyer, but there's no one who looks like her. Now, she's much taller than everybody else, so that does put her in a different position. Now, the point I wanted to make is when you have an actor like this who is atypical, right, who is not, you know, 5'6", blonde, skinny, and white, in general, people start – and they love – and people start loving the actor. They start writing roles for that person.
Yeah.
And that's what should have happened with her, where people start writing these roles for to take advantage of what she does. That's going to start happening a little bit, I think, with Elizabeth Debicki, right? Who also necessarily fit, but now people after Widows and Tenet, I think people are like, we gotta do this thing with her. But putting her in, you know, a typical Amy Adams role just isn't really gonna work because she's significantly taller than most of the people who play the love interest. So I do think that it was a lack of imagination. And obvious sexism and like obviously like, you know, male fragility that kind of put this particular actress in this particular box.
Yeah.
I don't personally think that she was a victim of age discrimination the way a lot of the other actresses were, because I do think that like you know whose role she should have been getting, who people do write roles for and have been for about 15 years is Tilda Swinton. Like, once people realized what Tilda Swinton can do, people were like, we can weaponize this thing.
Yeah.
100%.
But had someone like her 15 years – well, I guess Tilda Swinton's kind of broke out in Adaptation, which is like 5 years later. So they could have been writing those same kind of roles where like Janet McTeer could do everything earlier, but they just didn't. And they just they failed her and failed us.
And it makes sense, you know, that she's found a home on TV. She reminds me – in a different way, but in a way that you're talking about, of Sarah Lancashire, who is an actress I love. And she is in Happy Valley. I don't know if either of you watched Happy Valley. She was a star of Happy Valley, which was a crime, you know, a British crime drama. And they had it on Netflix. And that was written by, I think Sally Wainwright, who's done a couple things now with Sarah Lancashire, but she's a very specific kind of type and like this really distinguished British actress. And every time I watch her, I'm like, this woman is incredible. I believe her every second she is on screen. Like, she could be like the fact that no one in America basically knows who she is like, it blows my mind, because I'm like, this woman is probably one of the best actors working today that I've seen, but like no one knows who she is. And I feel that way about Janet McTeer, who has done a ton of Broadway shows too. Like, I would kill to see her on Broadway, and hopefully when it comes back eventually I'll get to see her. But like, in the same way, I mean, I think that she again is probably an intimidating presence, because Janet McTeer to me is just such a force. And I think some of that is because of her stage training. She has so much presence on screen. But yeah, I just think like probably no one knows what to do with her. And someone like Glenn Close is like, well, this is what people kind of think about me, so I'm going to put you in Albert Nobbs. Like,
I think that what people are afraid to talk about, but I'm not afraid, is Hollywood writes too many roles for women where a prerequisite is being traditionally attractive. I don't feel like people talk about that enough. So when you say like, there are basically two buckets in Hollywood. There's the bucket that is for women who can convincingly play a romantic lead. And I put that in quotes for people who, you know, aren't watching this. And there's a bucket for quote unquote actors. And those calls go to Meryl Streep, but then they go to Glenn Close, and then, you know, they Frances McDormand.
Yeah.
And Sarah Lancashire would be like that too. But when, you know, when you see Sarah Lancashire and I've seen Happy Valley, the first thing I thought of is, why doesn't Janet Petir have her Fargo? Right?
Which, yeah, just she would be great
on person with a job who's fucking good at it.
Yeah.
Like, the reason is because we don't write those roles. It's just that simple. We just don't write those roles. Because almost any movie fronted by a man has to have a stereotypically attractive woman in the lead.
Yeah. It's like such a problem too, but it's like such a stark contrast when I watch anything from like any other country that's not the United States. But I mean, I do spend a lot of time watching British television, especially because I find the writing on it so good.
Sure.
And it is, it's like British actors, like a lot of them aren't necessarily, this is not a slight on them, but a lot of them aren't necessarily conventionally attractive, or they're not like attractive in an American way.
I totally agree.
And so like, as a result, I think that they get more freedom to like actually act and do their jobs. Whereas like American actors are also worried about having to like look great on screen and like be sexy. And that gets in the way of so much stuff, which is probably why I like something like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Cause these look like normal people. As far as like, For as like attractive as someone like Kris Kristofferson was, and he was like, you know, a huge rock star and all this stuff. I shouldn't say was, because he's still alive, but like
he's still alive.
And he's still attractive.
But yeah, but it's like, I think that's my thing. It's like a weird thing, but a lot of 70s movies, I'm like, these people look like normal people. Like, it's kind of a little bit before we started doing this like super glossy thing. And I feel like people in the 70s feel like attractive for normal, like normal people, and now we're into a place where like people have to be, you know, everyone has veneers and everyone has like lip injections and everyone, you know, and like Janet McTeer is not that kind of actor. She's just like, no, throw me in a role, I'll make myself as ugly as I need to. I watched an interview with her talking about her doing like Shakespeare in the Park, and she was like, I just took like brown eyeshadow and I like smeared it all over my face, and I didn't look in the mirror because I had to look dirty and gross. And I didn't care, and it was great, and I felt so free, and I was like,
"That's pretty cool."
I'm like,
I mean,
where's my
I
energy?
Think that, yeah, I mean, listen, I don't watch Ozark, but I'm glad to hear that she's doing great stuff on it. And
you should.
Know.
She's basically the Gus Fring of Ozark, right? Wow. Like, she's that. It's that kind of presence. It's that kind of like, you know, like change of energy.
Sure.
The show, and to me, a lot of like Breaking Bad, like I think Breaking Bad's as good as it comes, but I think Breaking Bad changed dramatically when Gus came into the show.
I agree.
Yeah, for sure.
And she was that kind of thing where it's like, who is this? What is she doing? And how is she going to fuck up all these characters I care about? So it made everyone else better for it.
Emmy, on this show, we rate the episodes from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest.
But feel free to rate the episode.
You can rate the episode, too. I mean, you can. So I didn't see this film in 99 or even around 99. This was the first time I saw the film. I watched it yesterday. And, you know, as you can deduce, didn't hate it, didn't love it, kind of was whatever about it. I came into it thinking that the film was probably in the, I don't know, low 60s is kind of where I was at. 62, something like that. You know, having, you know, had this conversation with you guys, I'm certainly lower. I don't know that I'm necessarily in a place that I'm below 50 on it. But I think I'm at like a 51 in terms of, you know, I think that Janet Mateer is very good in it. And I think that if someone is looking for this type of film, you know, it's not terrible, in my humble opinion. But Kenny, what was your rating on this film?
You know, Phil, My as I said, I feel like I went on just not a roller coaster ride with this movie, but kind of like a straight kind of downward descent from a cliff. And I saw in my notes, like I said, like three times, like mm-hmm. different euphemisms for this movie sucks. I gave it a 30, which is low. Mm-hmm. And I almost want to give it two grades. I'm going to stick with a 30. But that said, like if someone gave it a higher grade on the basis of like there are some performances here which are kind of stellar within the context of a movie that is less than, I could understand that. I've seen people who frankly value film acting more than I do put review movies in that way. Like you must see this for Janet McTeer's performance. I would say you don't have to see this movie. However, that is it is kind of a marvel, and Kimberly Brown is to me like even more of a marvel. And it's not like the worst movie I've ever seen by a long shot. But again, I do feel like it's a bit of a disservice to the other movies that we've mentioned that kind of play in similar ground to say this is good, because I just don't think it is.
Just a quick question. Emmy, earlier today we recorded an episode on for our Patreon on Steven Spielberg's Always. Mm-hmm. And my question to you, Kenny, is this better or worse than Always?
It's a great question.
I think so.
This is worse than Always. Okay. This is worse than Always. Always is more ridiculous, like in every way, but Always is so much more watchable. Like I was super bored during this movie, and I was like not super bored during Always.
Emmy, what are your thoughts on 0 to 99 for Tumbleweeds?
God, I will probably rank it higher than both of you because I think I see what it's trying to do. I think it's good to have, ultimately it's still like a good mother-daughter story in terms of like, I like the relationship. I like a lot of the moments there. And I think like, it's like nice to have another movie that does that in the dearth of sure. like, I don't know if I just used that word correctly, of like so many male movies. I think it's like good, despite the fact that this has a male director and co-writer. I think I'd probably put it in like the high 50s to maybe like 60, because I don't think it's like, I see all of the problems with it that we have discussed.
Highlighted.
And it is not, you know, it's never gonna reach the echelons of other things I like better. Sure. But it's been a long time since I've seen Always, by the way, so I can't necessarily weigh in on that, but I would say that they're both ridiculous in their
Always
own ways.
Always is definitely
but
more
Always
ridiculous.
Always is incredibly ridiculous. I don't want Richard Dreyfuss as my angel.
Oh, you're the best.
That
was our takeaway, too.
I mean, like, listen, I have to admit that one of my ex-boyfriends, I think I'm realizing part of the reason I dated him was because he looked a little like Richard Dreyfuss's character, Matt Hooper, in Jaws. And I am obsessed sure. with
Jaws. I was going to say, the one great Richard
Dreyfuss. I'm obsessed with Jaws. I'm obsessed with Jaws, and I was like, maybe that was part of the appeal. But I don't want him as my angel. I don't want him... I don't want him as a concert pianist in the movie The Competition, which if you haven't seen it, please look it up on Amazon Prime.
Don't know that one, but I'm going to look that
it's
up.
It's terrible, yeah. And I think he maybe won a Razzie for it, but he wears the same hat through like the entire movie. That was clearly a character choice. Anyway.
I want to know what Richard Dreyfuss looks like right now, because I feel like Richard Dreyfuss...
He looks old.
He looked like 150 back in 89. He's got to look like...
He looks very old.
But the point is, I don't really know. I think I would say that this movie, for me, is better than Always, but it's been a long time since I've seen it. And my conclusion is that I don't want Richard Dreyfuss as my angel. If I had my choice, I'd probably pick like Celine Dion or the Three Dads from Mother.
wait, one last question. We also on that podcast did our top 10 Spielbergs. I'm curious, is Jaws your number one?
It's definitely top three for me. I really go back and forth on what my number one would be, but it's for sure top three. I actually had a guy completely deactivate and delete his entire Bumble account because I told him Jaws was one of my favorite movies. It's like, what's wrong with you? I'm happy to say that my boyfriend now has literally watched like every single documentary about Jaws. That was clearly meant to
be. He's a keeper.
It would definitely be top three for me. There's so many that I love. I'm a big, I'm always going to fight for Catch Me If You Can. I'm a huge Catch Me If You Can person. I love Raiders of the Lost Ark. I love E.T. I love Jurassic Park. I've dressed as Ellie Sattler. Like, there's so many of his movies that I love. Jaws is definitely top three. It might be my favorite because I think it's just
a great movie.
I think it's brilliant top to bottom.
Excellent.
So you brought up documentaries. So that's a great segue for our next week's episode. We're doing an episode on Mr. Death, the Errol Morris film. I don't know if you've ever seen that film, Emmy, by any chance.
I have not.
It is. It's a really great documentary. Errol Morris is a fascinating documentarian, and I'm excited to talk about him and to talk about Mr. Death with returning guest Simon Ennis, who a filmmaker and a friend of mine from Toronto, who's going to come on and talk about that with us. But Emmy, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was so much fun.
Thank you for dealing with Phil and I's little lover's quarrel.
That's fine. I like that every now and then. It just, you know,
I do.
It's good for men to express their emotions every now and then. Yeah, it's good for men. It's good and healthy for men to express their emotions. You did it in a very healthy way. I'm proud of both of you.
Oh, thank you. We appreciate that, Emmy.
You know.
I'm going to send you the list again. There's some additions to the list and see if there's anything else on there that you might want to come back for, because we'd love to talk with you again about something from 99 or 89. I'll send you some 89s, see if there's something on there that you're interested in it's coming on for, which we'd love to do that.
Probably.
More than anything, we'd like to thank everyone for listening. Please rate, review, subscribe on your various platforms. You can reach us at Twitter at podcastlike1999. We're also on Reddit now. We have a Reddit account. It's very exciting. We're also on Instagram. Thank you to Will and Ernie for producing the episodes, and to Sullivan for being our social media person. Thank you for listening.
And as always, to Jan for our art.
And Jan Katask, of course, for our key art and our theme song.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.